How's it going, you amazing people? And this is John Pepe with your amazing Action Comics Indie Comic Review. And I am very happy to have a special guest while Angel is on vacation. So this is our Indie Comic Review for what was yesterday, July 26th. The year of our Lord, 2023. And I am very excited to have on the show a gentleman that I've talked about often on the show. And I actually wished him a very happy birthday wish last week at the top of the interview with Kevin. And what better birthday gift for a guy who has no money and no time than to ask his friend of 30 plus years to come on and review comic books with me. So here we are, folks. I give to you Tom Palmer Jr. How's it going, Tom?
It's going good. Thanks for the intro. And thanks for the opportunity to join you today. It's a great gift.
When was the last time you read a new comic on a Wednesday?
It's been a long time. Yeah,
it has been. Do you remember the comic?
No, I don't.
So as folks may or may not know, Tom has quite a pedigree. His father, of course, is the iconic inker, Tom Palmer Sr. And Tom himself was a writer for Wizard Magazine. And I always say that Tom, you know, lit the torch that I carry today, because in Wizard Magazine, which primarily was, you know, superhero focused, Tom, of course, did the Palmer's Picks article, ran for about what, 75 issues?
Roughly
75.
Yeah.
Longest running feature in Wizard.
Yeah, longest running time by one writer. Yeah, I think they had longer features, but like rotating writers,
like,
and stuff.
Like casting call.
Yeah.
Like you're second to casting
letters
call.
Letters column.
Right.
Magic words.
And then you left Wizard to start an equally iconic magazine to Wizard called Toy Fair. This was one of the, you know, again, this Wizard had attitude, right? And you brought that over to Toy Fair because I think, as you had said at the time, in a previous interview we had done, most of the toy magazines at the time were very meh, right? There was like price guide, black and white pictures, you know.
Yeah, it was a catalog, like regurgitated photos of toys that were coming out. And,
And you guys,
we made the toys talk and fight each other and fart and vomit and just do stuff that they shouldn't be doing.
Or
and we took pictures of all of it.
Yes, it's all documented. Yes, yeah. You guys, you know, I think legitimized for a lot of people playing with toys, right? Mm-hmm. And yeah. You know, I'm an old man now. I'm 48 and a half. And I find myself watching a lot of YouTube now, and there's just this huge boom of like stop motion animation, you know, using toys and stuff. And I always feel like that, like, those are probably some guys who grew up on Toy Fair magazine, and some of the stuff that you did on the page, you know,
right,
inspired them to do the stop motion animation stuff. And and again, you talk about things that you did with toys that toys should be doing. I also always like to think about Zach Malamute, probably the late Zach Malamute, that threat
kind of made it, he wasn't.
That he was constantly eating like Mego figures and burying them, and and that was also all documented. So so for people who love to like play and demolish their toys, like Toy Fair was great. I think there were probably a lot of serious collectors out there that were like, "What are you guys doing?" And then we're gonna get into a little bit later, because Tom actually was an associate editor and did a fair amount of editing himself for one of the big two. So we want to talk about that a little bit later. But yeah, I gave Tom a comic to check out. And we're going to talk about that in a second. And I was really kind of excited to have an opportunity to talk about a first issue by this specific writer with Tom, because Tom kind of hooked me on this guy's work, way back when. So we're going to get to that a little bit, but I'm going to start with our first review. So this is from Image Comics. Now, Image Comics, they're top tier, you know, they're probably, you know, they're the third biggest behind DC and Marvel, but we always like to include them as an indie comic because they have such a great, at this point, at 30 years on, a diverse array of genres that they produce in comics. And I really think that when you're looking at a company that really has the most output and that so much of it is so different, you really do look at Image, because very little licensed books, right? Which a lot of the indie comics companies are really using to fund other stuff, but very little in licensed books. Definitely there's superhero fare, but there's also some slice of life stuff. There's magic stuff, mystery stuff. Of course, the obligatory genre for independent comics, the post-apocalyptic dystopian speculative fiction future that is really all over the place in these, because really, what better place could you do that? And they also are big on creator rights and creator-owned projects. So I always think that they're really good to look to, and they always have, you know, something really nice on the table. So this week's offering from Image Comics is called Per Evil. If I can get that in there, they tweaked the Image logo. All right, look at that little cat paw.
Oh,
yeah,
clever,
it's like the Paramount logo dissolving into the mountain and raises a lost ark. So this is my.
Are there cats in this book?
You know what? There aren't. I'm gonna get to that, because okay. I was a little disappointed. However, a little digression, because we definitely do these. I have enough cats right now in my life, as you guys might know from this is a podcast, as Tom knows. I already
if have anyone two. Wants a cat, I know
yeah, yeah, yeah. Just send a self-addressed stamped envelope, right? to my address, kittens do not bend on the envelope, and yeah, you might get a kitten in the mail. So so I have two adult cats.
Yeah, I just had a birthday, John, and you know, you could have surprised me.
I could have just foisted a kitten on you. Yeah. Yes. I felt this was a little less messy.
Yeah,
not cost you money in the long run, right? Yeah. Unless your stock goes down after this, which is always a possibility.
Unless there's going to be some lawsuits after today.
Oh, we're going to do some airing of the grievances later, I guess.
Right, but, yeah.
It's our,
how much time do you have?
Our Festivus in July special. So there's no cats in this. There's no furries. We'll get into this.
Okay.
Look, I'm gonna do the review. You just sit there and listen. And then
okay, I don't want to like interrupt.
No, okay. So we have two adult cats in our house here, and we had a cat in our backyard that gave birth to kittens. Three of them were claimed by our neighbors. While we have made an arrangement with an adoption group to get her, the mom, fixed so we can adopt her, we can take her in, we're fostering three of the kittens, and we're at the end of this 2 week, the most adorable nightmare I think I've ever, you know, I've had to experience.
Do you know who the father is?
I think there's three, actually, because they all look okay. Very different. Yeah. And I did this about 22 years.
No cat paternity or something.
We're contacting Maury. We are contacting Maury. Okay. But there's no, I've done this 22 years ago with a cat that I own, Smokey, the ubiquitous Smokey that I think you have met several times. Yeah. And her kittens. So fostering is a little bittersweet, because we say goodbye to them tomorrow. So it's really sad, but you know, we're going to try and link people up with them through the adoption agency. I don't know exactly how they're going to operate and run things, but yeah, we are recommending people. So yeah, you want in the lottery, let me know. The family might want another cat, right? I don't know.
No, sure. Why not?
Yeah, why not? So you, I guess, it doesn't matter, because it's what the family wants always, right?
Yeah, I have no say anymore.
You have no say.
So, I got half of a vote.
So, but you know what? You do get the opportunity to drive everybody around, and that's always nice.
Yeah, that's true.
So this Per Evil is written by Mirka Andolfo, illustrated by Laura Braga, with inks and background assists by Giovanni Manca, colored by Brian Valenza.
His last name is Manca?
Manca, M-A-N-C.
Oh, Manca, okay. Yeah.
Right. Lettered by Fabio Emilia, logo and book design by Fabrizio Verrocchi, edited by Davide Morando, associate editor Davide Gigi Chachi, and localization by Steve Orlando. So I think that what this is these are all Italian creators. And I guess in Italy, if your first name is Davide, you either become an editor or an associate editor of comic books. And Steve Orlando, I think he's an American author. I think he kind of well helped with the translation.
Americanizing this.
Yes. Yeah. So Mirka Andolfo, I have read a couple things by her. I think I reviewed the first issue of her sequel to Unnatural called Unnatural Blue Bloods. She's also done Sweet Paprika is a thing that she's done. And Mercy is another graphic novel that she, or trade paperback that is also available as the ads in the back will tell you. She mainly deals with anthropomorphic characters, the Unnatural stuff and Sweet Paprika, and usually deals very much in eroticism as well. Where this is not that. This, from what I've read from her and my experience with her, this is something a little different. She's trying a little something different here, which is kind of cool. It's a very intriguing mystery story. So basically, we have a setup with a mother and her daughter, basically just wiping out a bunch of guys, right? Just a whole room of guys just getting wiped out. And that happens in the two pages. And then we have like a flashback to a rock concert. And that kind of dissolves into a man looking at pictures of the rock concert. And you realize, and this is, I'm going to get to this in a little bit, but you kind of realize that he was at this concert with his wife who has just died. So now he is dealing with, you know, a teenage son, an unruly mother-in-law, and a wife who he apparently loved very much, who is no longer with him. He also is renting out, I guess, a room in this apartment to the mother and daughter that we saw earlier. And the son is, you know, they're both about 16 years old. So his son and the daughter of the pair that we saw at the beginning, they're kind of carrying on a little bit of a relationship. And it all sort of comes to a head when they run off together. He winds up going into the apartment to snoop, and you realize that there's some sort of deeper violent mystery underneath all of this, including the fact that the bassist of the band that we are focusing on died mysteriously at 16 years old, and the mother of this daughter has very similar tattoos and is also being hunted by the lead singer in that band. So we have a whole sort of rock and roll mystery here, which I thought was really cool. I love that aspect. I thought that Laura Braga's artwork was really good, nicely detailed. I thought the gore was handled really well. Wasn't overly goring, but you know, you do have what you want when you see someone's head explode from a bullet in nice comic color, right? So the book looks really good. I just, and this is something that kind of gets me sometimes, is that when you're a reader and you have to do a lot of the work to piece things together, it does make it a little hard to stay in the book. And I don't know if this is a translation issue or it's an editing thing. So case in point, you see the flashback to this rock concert. And in the middle of that flashback, you do see two people, right? And then you kind of dissolve from this bassist with the singer to a picture of the bassist and the singer, and then this guy looking at that picture, and then his son saying, "Mom's ready," and then you find out the mom is dead and they're at the funeral. And at first my mind goes to, was it the bassist who he is mourning? And it's like, oh wait, no, he's the guy and the girl that you see in this little side panel in this flashback. And I just, I get it, but it was a little hard for me, because then I had to kind of keep going back and looking at stuff, and I felt that it disrupted the flow of the story. Now, that being said, and we do encounter this a lot, we're going to talk about this with the next book too. It is a first issue of a larger work. I think this is slated to be an ongoing. I don't necessarily know if it's a miniseries, but there's a neat little mystery there to be explored. And there's some really nice artwork and some really good characterization. We are dealing more with sort of archetypes right now. So the characters are still yet to be fully fleshed out and explored. But I think that that's something that we will get to in this series. And I'm really curious about, you know, because there's these, like, on the cover, there are these, like, weird cats with multiple eyes. And this is sort of an imagery that runs through the book. And I kind of want to see where that goes as a cat nerd myself. But yeah, this is not about cats doing witchcraft. I think this is women doing witchcraft to fight something that only they could stop. And cats with multiple eyes are the source of their power. That's my guess on that book.
So is there enough here to have you stay with it, you think?
I'm gonna check out, I think, the first arc, kind of see where this goes. If it's a mini, then I guess I'm gonna be all in. To me, it is the most accessible of Mirka Andolfo's work that I have come across. Because, again, you know, and I haven't read Mercy, but that looks very interesting. But this, I kind of, like I said, the rock and roll mystery aspect of it, is this mother, the missing or the presumed dead rock star bassist? Like, I kind of like all that stuff. I like the setup. Mm-hmm. I really do like the artwork. It's more comic-y than manga. And Andolfo's stuff really does skew a little bit more towards that. She really pushes that line.
Yeah, right.
So I kind of like the groundedness of the artwork in this. And I thought the coloring was really effective. I think nothing is too dark, right? Even scenes that take place in the dark have nice pops of color. And I really like that. So it's a clean looking book, right? So I thought as a solid first issue, it really set it up nice. Just a couple little, like I said, I just think translation hiccups maybe, or maybe just, you know, just, and again, but it didn't overly impede my enjoyment of it. So Per Evil, number one by Image Comics. I encourage folks to check it out. It's neat, it's quirky, and it looks really cool. All right. So Tom, what do you have for us?
Well, I read a comic.
You read a comic. You did.
Yeah. It is The Ribbon Queen, number one, from AWA, and it's by the wonderful Garth Ennis and Jason Burroughs. And I don't know if you want to do the full credits rundown, John.
I can do that. Sure. I was just showing
you there in front of you.
I do. I was just showing the main cover on the little tablet there, courtesy of jokerschild.com, because I opted for the, actually, I love a sucker for these kind of movie poster variants. And it's got a really nice spoiler right there, right on the.
I was just gonna say, definitely spoiler.
I really love that, and it's you know, and I love when they do, like, it's got the folds, right? It's as if it was a one sheet that was folded, the folds in it. Yeah. So I really dug that. I thought that was really cool. I'm a big fan of what Axel Alonso is doing over at AWA. I like a lot of their presentation, and they always get some great talent. So yeah, this was written by Garth Ennis, penciled by Jason Burroughs, inked by Guillermo Ortego, colored by Dan Brown, lettered by Rob Steen, and I actually do not see any editing credits.
They have no editors there.
They have no editors. Well, you know what? It's like, that's part of, I think, what AWA does. It's sort of like, I think Axel is sort of like a de facto, like, he'll look over everything. And I know that, I think, buried somewhere. I think I found him in the past. Yeah, we have, so they basically have, like, an executive editor, Michael Cotton, right?
And a wizard editor,
Chris Burns. And a senior editor, Michael Coast, and then an associate editor, Dolce Montoya. So I think the way this kind of works is they are a small enough company and they have big talent, guys who've been doing this for a really long time, that it's sort of one editorial team for all the product, all the company. And much of AWA stuff actually takes place in a shared universe with a very thin connecting thread. But I think this is one of those that is sort of stands on its own. So you want to give us a quick rundown of the story?
Yeah, I'll try my best. I've told you before, I'm not that great at this quick rundowns, but it's a supernatural story about a police officer, Amy Sun, who discovers that the survivor of a serial killer has died by looks like maybe a suicide. She fell out of a window, but also had a stab wound in her chest. And Amy, the police officer, suspects that it might be the perpetrator of this crime might be the SWAT officer who actually saved her from the serial killer a couple years prior. And it's just basically this first issue is Amy's trying to piece together what happened to this woman. And she confronts the SWAT officer, who is not Billy Butcher, but looks surprisingly like him. And starts to uncover some crazy, weird, supernatural goings on around this murder victim. And we'll see where it goes in issue two. And I guess this is an 8-issue series, so we'll see what secrets she uncovers about the Ribbon Queen who we meet at the end of the first issue.
Yes. Yes.
And I thankfully saved everyone from the horrible solicitation copy for this book, which took me a couple of reads to actually make sense of. Longest run-on sentence. I haven't seen them run-on like that since I was editing someone's paper in college.
Yeah, I noticed that too. I don't know who does. That's interesting. I wonder who does that on what end. You know, is that an AWA?
I don't think Garth did that.
No, it's definitely not Garth. Although he has a great story in the back. You know, sort of an outro, and I like when authors do that. It's his unique voice, and it's really funny, and it's a little horrifying, and it does pair well, like a nice big pint and a steak. It does pair well with the ending of the book, which is, you know, typical Garthian fashion, just something ridiculous and horrific and seemingly very painful. I always equate it to, like, when you have a hangnail or that little piece of a skin and you pull, and like what happens,
pulling it too far,
it never stops, right? And so that was great. So what did you think?
You know, I enjoyed it. It was an enjoyable read because Garth is a pro. He's been doing this for a while. He knows what he's doing. As a overall package, as a first issue, I'm not completely sold. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of things that I thought were kind of missing. On the art side, it was a little pedestrian, very subdued. I think Jason Burroughs might be trying to do like a Steve Dillon-esque style, and you know, it kind of just brings up the fact that Dillon knew what he was doing, and you know, was really good at just drawing people doing things and making it dynamic, even when they're just doing ordinary things. And here in this book, you have a lot of people just, you know, talking and, you know, pointing and just, you know, sitting around at desks or standing next to each other. And it just looks very posed. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing dynamic about it. And, you know, it might be accurate the way people really look, but it's a comic book. You kind of want that, a little bit of exaggeration, a little bit of expression in someone's body or their body language. You know, you need to visually convey things and not just rely on the dialogue to carry the story. You know, I think they need to both work together to get the point across. And I think here, the writing is really crisp and dialogue is really good. And I think that carries a lot of the story along. And I think visually it doesn't really carry things because it's, you know, there's no expression to the people, you know, they're just kind of there in the space. You know, otherwise, you know, it looks nice. It's just not really exciting. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really look exciting.
Yeah. And I think that's a great comparison. I felt the same thing as far as right from the first couple pages, I was like, oh, Jason is definitely trying to do a Steve Dillon here. When he doesn't necessarily need to. And I think, you know, and it's, you know, Garth and Steve had such a great creative synchronicity or they just synced up really well. They kind of were in each other's heads, it felt like. They're two, they're obviously Preacher is their greatest work together. I think they, objectively did probably the best Punisher story, followed by arguably the worst Punisher story right after, because that Warzone follow-up was not as good as Welcome Back. And leaned way too, there's a point where Garth was leaning way too more into the ridiculousness. You know, it started to creep up in Preacher, and it was getting a little too much. And then, he pulled it back nicely. He had a nice save at the end of that series, wrapped that up the one of the best ways possible. And I think, his follow-up to Welcome Back Frank just really pushed the zany to such a degree that it was not as rewarding as Welcome Back Frank. And you mentioned The Boys in a roundabout way earlier. Dark Robertson is an incredibly, I would say can match Dylan as far as action and expression and making mundane look interesting, but such a wildly different style from Dylan.
Oh, sure.
As far as crammed with details, whereas Dylan was clean line, didn't add too much to it. And so,
But even his, the line quality in Dylan's work is, thick and thin, it suggests form just by the line. And here, this art, very dead line, doesn't really convey motion or depth or anything like that.
I absolutely agree. The variety of line that Steve used versus very much the same line throughout. And it does kind of make it makes the mundane scenes, just the people talking, a little more mundane. And it sort of does even, make the dialogue get lost a little bit as well.
It's carrying too much of the story.
Right. Yeah. But at that point, when you're just kind of like, when the art isn't pulling you in, then, the dialogue isn't doing what it should do. It should work together. Right. Mm-hmm. I kind of consider Ennis the Mamet of comics, as far as how he does dialogue and characters talking over each other and, in a really effective way, but still relaying information. And there was even a part in here where there was a piece of information that was relayed that kind of threw me, because it kind of felt incongruous to what we were already told. And it didn't quite fit with the information we were given. And I don't know if that's a throwaway or if that's a reveal later, and I don't know if that was a casualty of the art not conveying what was happening, because again, there was very little emotion expressed on the character's face. Like Amy just kind of has angry, pensive face in almost every shot, right? And so I felt like that was a hang up for me. And again, I don't know if that was an editorial call as well, like maybe something was missed or there's something there, which I do want to get into a little bit. But again, that being said, because I like Jason Burroughs as an artist and I like what he's attempting to do here. But I wish that he would, I wish it was a little more, his own, a little more dynamic. I really felt like, and I didn't do the research. I don't know if Garth and Jason have done stuff before.
For Avatar, maybe.
Maybe. Yeah. But even that stuff I felt was a little more dynamic,
What little could be the inker. I don't want to start throwing stones at people, but
It could be that. I thought the colors were competent. I thought the colors conveyed the
They're nice. They're nice.
Well, and kind of lifted, elevated the artwork to a degree. I will say,
make it sound like this book looks terrible. It looks nice. It's just, doesn't really carry the story the way it could.
It doesn't pop on the page.
Yeah.
I will say though, that last page, that last shot, the shock shot, He won that. I thought that was a really great, well illustrated page, and I kind of want to
really
see
nice
more
design of the reveal. Gore. Like yeah, the gore is very well designed.
Look painful. Yeah, that's kind of what you want, right? Yes. So I mean, overall, I really dug it. I'm in for the 8 issues, because again, this kind of fits in what I like. I like the detective mystery, but I like the weird supernatural aspect. And then I kind of like how it's Garth putting his spin on a lot of hot button topics that are going on right now.
What we forgot to mention, that it kind of weaves with the Black Lives Matter protests and the Me Too movement.
Yeah, which he says.
So, which we might, I'm assuming we'll get more into that as the story goes on.
Yeah. And it's interesting because Garth is really good at taking a side, but also showing another side. Mm-hmm. As well, so even when you have Connolly, the suspect, he at first comes across as one specific type, but then you kind of get a sense of there's a little bit of panic in there as well, as he professes his innocence, and I kind of bought it on the page, so I thought that was cool. I just like how Garth looks at people and recycles that on the page. I just think he's wonderful at characterization. And again, 20 some odd years after Preacher, which really was such in a lot of ways an essay on masculinity in the late 90s and what it meant to be a man, and what it meant to also grow as a man, to also understand that, maybe when you were younger and you needed a John Wayne as your paragon, you as you grow older and you gain empathy, you kind of learn, okay, I can keep some of the tough guy, but I also have to be a little more open to other ideas as well too.
Yeah,
I think Jesse's arc in Preacher is one of the greatest comic character arcs that I've ever encountered, and it's a shame that was completely lost in the TV series, but but yeah, so I dig it. The Ribbon Queen, I love it. Keep coming with these movie poster variant covers, and I'm in for the 8 issues. Garth, it's always great to see you do something. I missed the Marjorie Finnegan series, but I'm liking this first issue of this. So Tom,
John,
how you doing?
I'm okay.
good. So just in the time we have left, I kind of wanted to pick your brain a little bit, because you were, like I said before, associate editor, and you did editing as well at DC. Mm-hmm. You were the associate editor for the Superman line of comics at the time.
Initially when I started,
Which included at the time, four?
Four monthlies.
And then various spin-offs and events and things like that. Without dwelling too much on what you did at DC, just really quick, a couple of things you did there for the Superman titles. I think it's probably one of the most heat that was on Superman since the death of Superman, as far as interest and excitement among readers and followers alike. You did the President Lex Luthor storyline in 2000, and that culminated really well with the launch of a new Superman Batman series at the time.
Right.
And you also saw that Superman Red Sun, one of the most revered Elseworlds at the time, that was still a thing. One of those, the more revered and well-respected Elseworlds story. You actually wound up editing that, or mostly editing?
I rescued it from a drawer where it was sitting unfinished.
Yeah. And got that out there, and look at that. It was a hit as a story. There were action figures and an animated movie, and you saw it get printed. You saw it get released. You made them some money. So,
right. And
then you also were part of what I think was a great attempt to capture some of that Jim Lee Hush magic the For Tomorrow storyline that Jim Lee worked on. You did you do? No, that was after you.
No, that was after you. I was not involved in that one.
Ah, okay. Yeah. I thought that was like right at the end, but I guess I was off a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's see, had you been there, it would have been better.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about that.
gorgeous looking book though. And then a neat little title that you did. You did the Freedom Fighters. There was a revival of the Freedom Fighters in the early 2000s. You did that with Daniel Acuna doing art. Gorgeous artist, but I can't read him after a certain time of night because he makes me sleepy. But he is one of the best artists out there.
The colors?
It's the mutedness and it's the fuzziness, you know.
Right.
And and then you did a series that I thought was really fun was the Son of Vulcan series.
Oh yeah,
that was really fun and a little out there.
My old boss at Toy Fair was the writer on that.
That's right. And that was really fun. That was that was something that leaned more into an animated style. Which I think worked really well for the material. And then one of the things
Go.
What?
You're going to Teen Titans Go?
Teen Titans Go? I forgot that you were on Teen Titans Go. That was huge. You made them a lot of money there, too.
Apparently that's like, the revival with the cartoon. That was kind of like, kind of the same, the irreverence that the comic book kind of had.
And then the two versions crossed over, right? In an animated movie. But that original flavor, Teen Titans Go, animated, for folks who don't know, the early 2000s there was a Teen Titans animated series that Glenn Murakami developed, and he was one of the Batman, Bruce Timm Batman guys, and at that time DC did the tie-in comic, which was called Teen Titans Go. Later on, Teen Titans Go became the name of an even more wacky and really further pushed cartoony style Teen Titans Go cartoon show. But the longevity of what you did is still there. Those trade paperbacks are still in print. People still gobble them up because it is a weird niche that people love with these Teen Titans and these animated versions. Both styles seem to carry an equal lot of weight and love. And that was always a fun book. That was really neat. And you also were involved in yet another retelling of Bruce Wayne's origins into becoming Batman, right? Journey into Night. That was
I forgot about that one.
Sure. Yeah, you worked on that one too. Yep. It's okay, Tom. It was forgotten about pretty much after it was finished up. So what I really want to talk about in the time we have left here is what is the job of an editor? What are you doing to make these comics come out on time and make sense?
Oh, there's a lot of like probably four or five different ways to answer that. Really, the better editors in comics, and you look at like the classic Archie Goodwin was like revered as probably one of the best editors in comics. And really what he did is just hired the right people and kind of got out of the way and let them do what they're going to do. Unfortunately, that doesn't work all the time. But then you have, the other extreme of that where you have editors who are very heavy handed and will be involved in every aspect of the comic and, from the writing to, thumbnailing the artwork and going over those with an artist. That approach has its merits, but then, you're not getting what you're hiring that person to do. You're becoming the writer or you're becoming the artist. And personally, I don't feel that's what an editor should be doing. Ideally, it's probably somewhere in between those two extremes of, completely hands off and completely hands on. You should have like a light touch of pushing people in the right direction of, where you think the story should go or what you're expecting as a reader, because really as that editor, you're the first reader of that comic and you have to be the first eyes that see that artwork and read those words. And you have to anticipate what someone reading it is going to feel and what they're going to think, and are they going to get lost? Do they need something more here? What will make them come back? the following month to keep reading. Is this a clear story? You know, is this clearly told? Is the art accomplishing what it's supposed to be doing? You know, what ways could it be better? Because you want that comic to be the best comic that it can be. Mm-hmm. And you have to do it every month, which is the hard part when, you know, the workload of these artists now is, you know, it's a lot harder than it was when we were younger and you're reading a comic and, you know, the printing's kind of crappy. You don't have to be as detailed in the art because it's not all going to show up on the page. Nowadays, artists have to do a lot of work and, you know, you're lucky if you can get someone to do one book in a month. And, you know, whereas back in the day, you know, John Byrne was doing what, three or four books a month. Right. And they all looked good, but, you know, that art style doesn't hold up today. You know, you need, you know, the Brian Hitch style where everything's there on the page and people expect that and they want that every month. And it's kind of impossible to draw 20 pages of that in a month and then do it again the next month. Mm-hmm. So you kind of, as an editor, you kind of have to balance that and figure out, you know, can we get ahead of schedule somehow? Can we, you know, find some other way to get this book out? Or just, is this a popular enough book that it can just wait, you know, that you can fight that battle with the people who want the book out at the company and say, well, no, people are buying this book because you have this writer, you have this artist, and it's worth it, you know, for them to wait. Otherwise, if you get some C-lister to come in to draw the end of the story, no one's going to buy it and no one's going to buy the trade paperback because, you know, it's not going to be a perennial seller because, you know, your hot A-list artist didn't finish the story, you know, and that's your selling point for this book. Yeah. So basically being an editor, you have to do so many jobs and do it all on time and do it well and not screw it up and, you know, basically not make enough money to eat every month. So that's basically the job of an editor in comics, which might have changed by the, you know, in the years that I've haven't been doing it.
Right. Right. Cause this is about 20 years ago we're talking. And you know, it's a couple of things. Oh, go ahead.
We have 15 years.
Oh yeah. It was 2006.
Roughly around there.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned something about the simplistic art style of John Byrne, who even, you know, back then wasn't simplistic, right?
No,
people
no.
were like, look at the details this guy's putting in, you know. But today he would establish
a shot, a background in a on a page, and then the next three pages in that scene, no backgrounds.
Because it's interesting because, you know, there's a lot of looking at artists like Scotty Young, right? Scotty Young has very varied art styles. He can do really realistic, detailed stuff, but his bread and butter right now is the cartoony stuff, right? But even that might look simple to the uninitiated, but if you really look at the artwork, there's a lot going on there. It is not simple at all. Like there's a lot going on. There's a lot of line work in there that he's putting in that I think doesn't necessarily, you know, at first, oh, it's just a cute picture of that Marvel character in this goofy animated style. But then you kind of look at the detail and what he puts in there. And he's insanely popular. And then I look at something like Joe Kelly, who you have worked with as an editor. And, you know, his current series, The Great Immortal Sergeant, is such a fun yarn that I think some people are missing because it has a very simple looking art style, very bare bones. But again, once you look into that, you see the work at play, the way it actually everything is designed to kind of convey motion throughout in as few lines as possible. But it kind of, I equate it to like squiggle vision and animation, you know, the artwork in that. And I just, again, I feel like that because that is a black and white cartoony looking book, it's getting lost on the shelves by some people, you know. So that was an interesting point that you made, like that how things now, you know, hyper detail, hyper realism in a lot of cases, you know. And even to the point where artists like Alex Ross, who were praised for their hyper realism 20-25 years ago, even now they're not as in favor anymore, you know,
right?
With some of this other stuff that's going on now. when it comes to correcting something, like, so you said, make sure the story makes sense, make sure it reads well. You know, we talked about a couple hiccups that I had in reading, you know, in reading these two books, these two little weird moments, at least. So obviously it's more important to catch that at script stage, right?
Yeah, that's the key, because it's, once the book's drawn, it's nearly impossible. And I know this was the case when I was editing books, and it's probably really, really, really the case now. But there's no time, you know, right. The books are out the door, especially at the big two, you know, the books are out the door as you're working on them. So you kind of, you're not getting things redrawn unless it's really has to be done, for legal reasons, you know, or something.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know,
so because of that time crunch, if the artist misses this step or does this thing, because of that time crunch, it's just like, okay, let it go. And, you know,
yeah. You just gotta do your best. And, you know, and that goes back to the original point I was making, is that, you know, you have to be the Archie Goodwin type who hires the right people who know what they're doing, and, you know,
get it right the first time.
Get out of their way and let them do what they're doing. And, you know, unfortunately, there aren't that many people out there who know what they're doing. So they might not have all those skills of, you know, what's clear storytelling. It might be a nicely drawn picture, but is it clear storytelling visually? And a lot of times it isn't. You know, something, you could be the, you know, the greatest draftsman, and, you know, you put so many lines on the page, but you know, if you're not directing the reader's eye the right way, it's not going to read like a comic. It's going to read like a bunch of nice pictures, you know, next to each other on a page. Art Adams, a lot of lines on the page, but he also knows how to direct your eye and make the story flow and make the entire page a composition, and to get the reader to follow from the top of the page and across and down the page. You know, it's a skill you can learn, or you can just be born with it and just, you know, read things visually and know how to tell a story visually. But a lot of people don't know how to do it, and they don't focus on that. And I think a lot of editing doesn't focus on that. A lot of editing just focuses on the script and the writing. And I know a lot of editors don't really have a background in art. They have a background in writing. You know, and you kind of need both. You kind of need, ideally, a background in comics, in some sort of education form, or, you know, actually doing comics, actually making comics, because I think it helps you convey to the talent what you need them to do and how you need them to do it, and the best way to get that across on the page.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I imagine now, with so much being done digitally, that we're far away now from every comic being drawn on bristleboard, right? And inked on paper, and, you know, and it's all digital. And I guess that would make it easier now for a late running art change, but
sometimes it doesn't. You know,
sometimes, like, it doesn't. Yeah.
Yeah. The art doesn't, it's not like you click a button and you fix the art. You gotta still have to draw it, you know?
Yeah, it still has to be produced. Yeah. But as far as, you know, because there's always, you know, you always hear stories about, especially like with the Marvel bullpen days, of like, oh, you know, there, we had some problems with this book. And so we had four artists and two editors spending all night tweaking the artwork and doing paste ups and mock ups and adjusting that, you know, in a hotel room at night, you know, like,
Jack Kirby's face is getting redrawn on Superman, you know, like,
right. Oh, yeah. And I know that you had to retouch some stuff. You've had to put some hand on artwork as well and in your time, correct? Or no, you never had to do that. Okay, good.
No. You're not allowed to.
Oh, that, okay. Interesting. That's there's a rule against.
Yeah, the production department is there for that.
Okay, gotcha. You know, but it is, you know, very rare once that book is done to go do a late running art change. And you mentioned something about, you know, you talk about Archie Goodwin, probably, one of the greatest editors in the history of comics, because he was a writer. Knew the fundamentals of storytelling. You feel that writers do make the best editors?
I guess if you're writing comics and, you know, you're good at it, and you know not to overwrite.
Right.
You know, Archie never overwrote his pages. You know, it was a good balance of dialogue on the page. You know, there's other writers out there from that era who, you know, would write too much. And Archie did draw too. It might be cartoony, but you know, so I think having that ability to draw, you know, you could be a writer who can't draw or doesn't think visually. You could be a great writer, but you just don't think visually. I think it's a different skill set that you can't really, it's hard to teach, I think. And it's hard to know if you have it. But there's definitely a different way of thinking if you think visually, if you think, you know, how you compose a panel and, you know, how you lead the reader around a page.
And it's, it's interesting because there are definitely a lot of successful editors out there, like Julie Schwartz, who wasn't a writer, you know, he was pretty much an editor, you know,
a little handsy.
I was going to use the term dictator, but in the sense that he dictated what he wanted to see in a comic book and on the cover.
I was going to say he was handsy, like he was hands-on on certain people, but you know.
Well, sure, yeah, but he was very hands-on editor. But then, you know, and I think of guys like Mark Grunewald, who was a great writer and a great editor. Guys like Denny O'Neill, who I find was probably a better editor than he was an actual writer. I think, you know, the themes he explored were great, but I always felt like his dialogue was a little stilted sometimes, but a tremendous editor and because he knew how to drive a story and how to tell a story. I know that your bread and butter, as far as when it comes to the comic medium, is independent comics. The quirkier, the better, you know, and you've introduced me to some great titles besides Preacher, but like Cheeseheads was this great old book that I loved. the Steve Yzerman stuff, Yikes, Tykes, like all that kind of stuff. You're a big fan of mutual friend James Kochalka, you know, very cartoony style and things like that. And a lot of these guys started in the, you know, that sort of indie underground scene doing their, you know, back then when it was all still paper, pre-internet, doing mini comics, chat books, getting it out there, really word of mouth in the hopes that if you couldn't self-publish it, maybe someone might pick it up. How do you feel? And I think we're kind of going to wrap it up with this a little bit, but aside from, you know, how technology has affected the production of comics on an editorial aspect, how do you feel about how technology is now enabling a lot of these creators to reach as wide an audience as possible through crowdfunding campaigns and internet word of mouth and things like that? You think that's a better thing, a great thing right now? Do you think that it's encouraging people to be more creative, or is it encouraging people to be a little lazy?
Well, no, I think it's very creative.
Cool.
You know, personally, like most of the stuff I'm reading is stuff that's, you know, people self-publishing now or crowdfunding. You know, it's very, I won't say it's easy, but it's a lot easier to do like a small print run of something and, you know, get it out there to people who want to see it. You know, it's really kind of opened the market up to everyone. You don't really need the comic store distribution anymore. You know, you can kind of go direct to the reader, and it's really just a matter of finding the readers and getting them to get into your stuff and getting it to them. And I think crowdfunding and micro printing is really kind of made that explode in the last couple of years. I think probably because of the COVID shutdown is really where it kind of took off, where a lot of people just were home and, you know, they were able to focus on drawing and, you know, they weren't able to do any of the conventions, you know, or the small press shows where you would meet people and you could kind of sell your comic to them in person. And instead people were kind of going on the internet and, you know, Instagram pages or whatever. And, you know, selling their stuff and putting it up there and getting people interested in it. And I think that's, you know, it's making the art form healthier. You know, it might not be great for, you know, the major companies. It might be hard for them, but, you know, I think as an art form, comics, it might be moving in that direction. Mm-hmm. And definitely more the creativity out there.
Yeah. And the creativity as well in marketing yourself and what mm-hmm. you could add to like tiers on your things. You know, like we got guys who do little 3D, you know, offer 3D figurines of their mm-hmm. their characters that they've created. You know, and when I said lazy, I kind of mean like exactly what you kind of talked about not having to go to a convention and shop your wares that way. But a lot of the more successful ones are people who do both, right? They're still doing the crowdfunding, but they're still hitting the streets, going to conventions, going to shops, because I still think shops are important to the life of the medium. And I always love when, you know, an independent creator comes in with their book to be like, do you want to carry this book? I always think that's a great thing that's still out there. It's still happening. And the other thing I think is great with this sort of, you know, what internet has done for getting these smaller works out there, is you always hear those horror stories of, oh, I brought my stuff to a convention and I showed it to this guy, you know, this editor or this bigwig or whatever, and they're like, ah, oh, it's garbage, and that person's like, ah, oh, I'm garbage, and then that's it, they're done, mm-hmm. right? They don't want to go back. This, I think, gives people the courage to continue. Right. To that mm-hmm. it's like, oh, well, I'm not talking to some guy, you know, who makes a decision. I'm talking to people who are into this stuff and are into what I'm doing and building a following that way. So I always think that's mm-hmm. a great way to build that community. And I, again, these creators we've talked to that have been doing these Kickstarters and these, you know, GoFundMes and Patreons and stuff, God bless them, because yeah, that is the future of the industry. And it is allowing, again, for more diverse content to get out there and for creators to have their voices be heard and have their art be seen. Yeah. Well, I think
you guys want any recommendations?
Yeah, I was gonna ask, what is your current favorites right now?
Well, actually, there's a book coming out from Oni in a couple weeks, I think August 9th, mm-hmm. Called Dwellings.
Yes, yeah.
And it's actually I have the first issue here.
How did it's you actually, get the first issue?
Well, this is not the first issue. This is the crowdfunded
first issue.
Oni's repackaging the first two issues together. There's going to be, I guess, three books from Oni repackaging the six issues of Dwellings that have been crowdfunded.
Cool.
But it's a mashup of Harvey style comics with like 70s horror movies.
Nice.
So think like, you know, like The Exorcist, but drawn in like the Harvey style. It's not, you know, story of The Exorcist, but like, you know,
and not actually hot stuff, but yeah, in that.
In that style, you know, that, you know.
Well, that's great. And who's doing this? Jay Stevens. Jet Cat Stevens. Nice.
Right. Yeah. Titan Stein cartoon. So
yeah. See, that's crazy to me that Jay Stevens mm-hmm. had to do a crowdfunding in order for Oni to publish his comic.
Yeah. And it was Black Eye Comics, which was his old publisher back in the day, is mm-hmm. doing the crowdfunding.
Okay.
But they have a whole line of books that they crowdfund everything. Huh. But yeah, it's really good, really good horror stories. You know, the ads are in that old style, and the art kind of looks like a, you know, it's got that newsprint feel to it.
Yeah.
On the art with the big dots and everything. But the ads are actually part of the story.
Oh, cool.
It's like, nice. Yeah, it kind of gives you, as you're reading, like, don't skip over them, like read them as you're reading. Because it gives you insight into what's going on. But yeah, really, really well done. Really interesting horror stuff. You know, the style kind of meshes really well with the horror. You wouldn't think it would, but it's perfect.
Oh, so, that's great. I'll look
for that. Pick that up in a couple of weeks when it comes out.
Awesome. That's a great tip. Great recommend there. You got another one right now, or is that's the one you're hot?
If you want to go eBay hunting, because it's not out anymore. I've got piles, John.
Look at this. He's got you're like Carrot Top. You got props.
Is that shiny? Is it too shiny?
I can't read. It's a little shiny.
You will
I like
own
it.
Nothing, and you will be happy.
Oh, interesting. And who's
that? Familiar with Simon Hanselman?
No.
Meg Mog and Owl?
No. Yeah.
Wow. It's like way too stoner. Yeah, stoner comedy. Fantagraphics does a bunch of graphic novels.
Okay.
Check them out. It's a cool stoner comedy.
Nice.
But this is a stoner comedy mixed with The Walking Dead.
Oh, cool. All right. I like it. I like it. Nice. Yeah.
Well, I think he might be reprinting it when the second issue comes out.
But, all right. Cool. Yeah. And that's through Fantagraphics, or is he doing that?
No, he's self-publishing that. Okay. He's self-publishing that right now. Yeah. But his other graphic novels are out from Fantagraphics. Definitely pick them up. They are hilarious if you're into the stoner brand of humor.
Well, like I said, that's a bit of my wheelhouse. And I like the clean black and white line art over there. That's nice.
Oh, yeah. No, he does the stuff from Fantagraphics is full color. But pick up Crisis Zone, which is he serialized on his Instagram during the pandemic, the story every day. So he did page of comics, not for his every day, but anyway, but he did, serialize this whole comic about his characters in real time experience the pandemic. And it's just crazy stuff. It's really hilarious and topical. David Cho is in it. And horrible stuff happens to him. It's great. It's really good.
All right. Very
really
cool.
Recommend that.
Nice. Thank you. That's three recommendations from Tom Palmer Jr., folks. Those are some fantastic Palmer's picks. What a good name.
That's trademark, man.
You should use that. Oh, man. Tom, thank you so much for coming on. I had a blast. This is really fun, really educational, too. It was pure edutainment. I like that. Folks, if you like this and any of our podcasts, hit the like button, subscribe. That means a lot. Share it with other people, too. That even means even more if you just share this link and pass it around, like an old comic book, you used to pass around when we were kids. So you got to read this. Who's this little Canadian guy? So, folks, this will wrap up this week's edition of the Indie Comics Spotlight and Review Show because, yes, we reviewed and we spotlighted with Tom Palmer Jr. So that was a lot of fun. That was great. Thank you, Tom. Folks, be sure to visit your local comic shops because, again, they are definitely the key to keeping comic books out there in circulation, getting them in the hands of kids, adults, and the young at heart. Sure, why not? I get my comics at The Joker's Child in Fairlawn, New Jersey, where we do our best to carry as wide array of comics as we can because we love comics and we love our customers who also love comics. Tom, question.
John.
What's the first comic shop you ever went to?
Schiller's Bookstore.
Schiller's Bookstore, yes.
Yeah.
Schiller's Bookstore existed in the Garden State Plaza Mall. And yes,
it was enclosed. It was an open air mall.
Open air mall. And I remember I used to get comics there as well. And they were an actual bookstore that sold comics. And yeah, I guess that was in the early days of direct
early
market.
80s, early 1980s. Yeah. I guess they had full direct market line. It wasn't just like a newsstand. Yeah.
Yep. No, they were great, man. They were great. I had the pleasure of working with Stuart. Remember Stuart? I think Stu from Schiller. He was the tall guy with the beard and the hair.
Okay.
I worked with him at a shop in Ridgewood a bunch of years later. Really nice guy. Yeah, really great guy. Yeah. And Schiller's was definitely a magical place growing up. I'll let it count since it was a bookstore that sold comics, but it was a direct market. I'll let it count.
There were comics around the house all the time, so I didn't really have to go to the comic store. Like they're growing everywhere.
It's true. Because I always like to say like comic shops, local comic shops, they're part clubhouse, part museum. Everyone's a little different, but they also kind of carry the same stuff. So it's always fun to see the similarities and the differences. So I always like to, whenever I'm in a town, check out a nice local comic shop and just see how they're all doing. So yeah, folks, that'll wrap it up for this week. Tom's got to go and shuttle some family around, and I got to do some kitten wrangling because this partition was actually blocking them from the back door. So we could have some problems once I'm done with this. But folks, join us next week. Angel will be back from.
Are we doing a high five?
And we want to. Yeah, we're gonna do this high five. How do we do this? Yeah, high five. All right, folks, thanks for watching again. Like, subscribe, check out amazingactioncomics.com. If you are a creator and you would like to be on the podcast, let us know. Or if you'd like us to review your book, let us know. Reach out to us. These are the socials that I have access to right here, right now. And see you next week. Oh, wait, I totally forgot to say the sign off. Folks, again, Angel's not here to do it, so I'm going to do it. Remember to be amazing, stay amazing, and read something amazing.